Welcome. I have got the awesome Aaron Christie David from Atelier Wealth with me today. Thank you for joining me, Aaron.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. So we're going to get straight into it. Now, you are a mortgage broker.
Yes.
Yes. So I'd love to know why you became a mortgage broker. What was the epiphany that you had and said, I need to do this? Yeah,
look, I mean, you could call it an epiphany. My background was in financial services, but I used to work in marketing and I used to take care of home loan distribution through mortgage brokers. So I had a pretty good idea about what mortgage brokers did. And because I worked inside a bank at CBA, I had a pretty good idea about how the product worked itself as a home loan product. The epiphany really was Bernie and I, my wife Bernie and I, were on our honeymoon and we're in Vietnam and we're kind of sitting on a crate eating a banh mi, as you do. And
as you do,
$2 that it probably cost us. And I guess it's that, some people have that moment when they have kids or have a family or maybe happens at a certain age in life where they're just like, what am I doing? And at that point, we had pretty good corporate roles. Bernadette was in human resources for Cricket New South Wales. I used to work in marketing at Commonwealth Bank. So our ultimate dream was to go and move to New York and kind of chase a dream of, studying and then improving our corporate careers. Maybe it was an MBA or something along those lines. And as we sat there and planned it out, it was like, hang on, what are we going to do? We're going to struggle as renters in New York. We're going to come back with this giant amount of debt from a student loan as well. Then we're going to work corporate careers that will probably take us away from each other and potentially a family to start in the future to chase this corporate dream. And, the payoff would be great, as you move up in corporate. But then it just didn't sit right. Mm. And I thought, hang on, there had to be a better way. And my older brother was just starting his MBA at the time. We were both going to do it together. And I just thought, I'm going to put that money into a business and see how we go.
Yeah.
So he's done his studies and he's obviously moved up. He's become a CFO now. So obviously it's paid off dividends for him. But for me, now our business will turn 8 in July this year. And where we started to where we are now 8 years later, it's definitely a journey and something that we're proud of. Not without its moments, like any roller coaster ride.
Tell me about it. Yeah.
Tell you about it. And I think the transition to mortgage broking was a kind of a smoother one, given that I'd bought properties, been through it. That doesn't necessarily give you the skill set to become a broker. It just gives you an idea about what's involved. The fire in me was, why don't I help people build property portfolios? That was my ultimate goal. To have that level of cushion in their retirement and an idea that then you could pretty much control your work. Could you dial down to 4 days, 3 days? Could you work doing something you really enjoyed as opposed to trading your time for a paycheck? And that then became, that ethos that now we're famous for.
Yeah, I love that. So what made you decide to work together? What was the conversation around that? And on your honeymoon too. I mean, that's pretty brave, deciding to start a business together on a honeymoon.
Yeah.
So tell me about that conversation. And how did you decide what roles each of you would take within the business?
So at that time, we really didn't know what we didn't know. So that was my dream, was to start the business, and Bernie really supported me on that. So 2 weeks later, after we came back from our honeymoon, Bernie's like, hey, look, you haven't done anything about this business idea that you had. And I was like, great. And I then found a mortgage choice business, which was for sale in Alexandria. And I bought that 2 weeks once we got back and used all our savings. And at that point, I just had to fail forward. Like for me, I hadn't been in lending, so I had to understand the lending processes. I had to understand how the mortgage broking role really kind of hit a sweet spot with people as well. And Bernie would then come after her job and help me out. And that was how Bernie really kind of got involved at the start, weekends, after hours, just helping me with a lot of the paperwork, with a lot of the data entry. And at some point we got to a real tipping point, which was, hey, I need to hire someone, I need to recruit someone. Can we afford to replace your income? And I said, look, jump into the business and let's try and work this out. And that was that moment where Bernie came in. She was doing it for free and then she got paid. And then our next recruit was Bernie's brother, Damien, who joined us a few months later. And again, the same thing for Damien was, hey, mate, we just need a bit of a hand. Can you come in and spare us a day or two and just give us a helping hand? And, you know, a day or two turned into three, turned into four. I was like, mate, can we make this full time? And then when Damien joined us, it became that perfect trilogy for us, which, team, we didn't really step on each other's toes. I kind of assumed sales, marketing, business development. Bernie was really the ops, the IT, finances as well, given that's her background too. And then Damien was very much the technician, so product delivery and a lot of that support role. So we naturally just gravitated to what our strengths were, and we had each other's weaknesses covered. And even to this day, I think we've got a really good working relationship because we know we can't do what each other does. And so when you know that you can't survive without each other, it kind of has that little solidarity in the team going, we need each other. No one's got a bigger ego than everyone else because it's like, hey, we're pretty much equals.
So I really love that you all play to your strengths. And I think that's probably what has made you such a success. You know your lane and you've stuck to it. You're not trying to do something that you don't know. So you're all kind of taken on that role and just kind of full steam ahead. And with the one big goal in mind.
I know, we're jumping in and out. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about your personal relationship a little bit with Bernie, but don't worry, I'm not going to get beyond the bank accounts. it's okay, no secrets exposed, Bernie. Look, I just want to know, I'm really big on couples because we see a lot in our practice when couples don't have conversations about money, about their goals and what they want to achieve, especially, you know, if you let it go years and years, then it's a harder conversation to have, obviously. So how do you and Bernie go about having those money conversations for your personal life and setting your financial goals? So do you sit down and talk about where you want the business to go, and then personally, what sort of wealth you want to accumulate, what your plans are coming into retirement? And you have young children too, still at school. So what are the conversations you have around supporting them potentially? Because I know a lot of couples have different opinions of how you should support your children depending on the background you're from. So I'd really love to hear about all of the things there.
Great. I think like all relationships, money is a big one. And it's certainly the start of our relationship. You know, I was frivolous. You know, I was the spender in the relationship, which is probably counterintuitive to how this type of relationship should be. And Bernie's the diligent. I mean, she had a background in tax and accounting, and she's, you know, she loves spreadsheets. She helped her parents pay off their mortgage, you know, as quickly as possible. Whereas my family didn't speak. Yeah, my family didn't speak about money, Kylie. So for us, you know, we grew up with that. It's rude to talk about money versus their family is very open about money. And that, again, was a real shift. You know, I would have grown up never knowing how much my parents' mortgage was or if they even had a mortgage at some point when it was paid off. So that takes a lot to reshape how you look at money. I know we've spoken about this as well, right, from your journey. But I think it's like when you get to those moments where things are uncomfortable and you come to a bit of a head about, you know, loggerheads over money, it's like this is a good time to have a conversation. So I was very clear at the start. Bernie handled all the banking and finance for us. I just got told how much I could spend or what we were aiming to save and what I needed to earn. And like, I can work with that. I can work with those type of confines as well. Yeah. And look, when I started the business, I think at that point we had two investment properties and we were renting, and Bernie's income would have been maybe 55K. That's tough on a business that isn't producing income for the first 12 months, really, right?
Yeah.
So we had to, you know, I'd tap my card and go, I don't even know if there's any money on this. That moment of truth, right? And
you're waiting for the little thing to spin and like, did they get accepted?
Correct. And you're like, oh, wrong card, sorry. And you're like, you think on your feet a little bit. Which you at that point you go, geez, no, never again. And I think that was for me that turning point where I'm like, I have to make this business work because the other thing is going back into a corporate gig, which I was like, I think I'm done. So that would fuse in me. And look, over time, you know, we rent, we've done it all. We've rented, we've renovated, we've bought properties, we've bought off the plan, we've sold properties. I feel like we had a lot going on in our 20s and 30s from a property perspective that gave us insights.
Yeah.
But we knew ultimately we wanted to buy our own home. That was non-negotiable. We want to put down roots, want to buy our own home, have that security, stability. And, we were fortunate probably about, I'm going to say, 3 years ago to be able to buy in a great place down the coast. And, obviously having a mortgage, that's a big commitment. Even being a mortgage broker doesn't make me immune to the fact that when you get 13 rate rises, something has to give, right? So we'll just figure out it before. Like that's the RBA wanted people to feel a bit of hurt and pain, and 13 rate rises will certainly do that to many households that have a mortgage, that have kids, that want to have a lifestyle as well. And at that point, you really got to be open and honest about what is non-negotiable and what is up. Discretionary, and so discretionary spending definitely dialed down. You mentioned around kids, and we weren't willing to take the kids out of, say, swimming or little athletics or dance. So that meant personal spending dropped back to make sure that we put our kids as a priority first and foremost. Whereas, I look at the swimming classes 2 years ago, you couldn't get in versus now. It's noticeable how empty the class, emptier.
Yeah,
the
wow, are. That's interesting, wow. Isn't it? Yeah,
it's telling. Yeah. It's telling.
I mean, swimming is something that kids need to do.
Yeah, but on a family that's on a budget, for example, that's maybe where they go. Hey, look, and they could be down to one income having another baby. So you just don't know what people's scenarios or situation is. But I think going through this gave me a huge amount of empathy. That when I'm talking to clients, I'm like, hey, but what about this or what about this? And sometimes you don't see, you don't know what you don't know, or you don't see what you can't see until you get to that point.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, I was pretty adamant personally that I wanted the girls to have a pot of money when they got to 18. So what we've done is every week they each get $100. That sits in a bank account compounding nicely away for them. And even when times, got skinnier as well, we said, no, that's a non-negotiable too. Mm-hmm. That's their $100 each week. And, anytime they get money for their birthdays or Christmas, it's like it goes straight into their bank account as well. And that money, when they turn 18, can only be used to buy a property. And that's kind of my my mandate. You can only use that money to buy a property. That's you want to buy a car, you want to go on holidays, you save, you go get a job and you work for that, but you use that money to go and buy a property.
I love that. And we did similar for our boys, but we set up a managed fund for them. So then when they started working, we encouraged them to put their own money into that so that it, compounded, and they got the dollar cost averaging for a little bit. So, and then once they turned 18, it was just signed over to them and said, that's your money. You want to go study or whatever. I think we've raised our boys well. They haven't cashed out any of it yet. They're just like, no, I don't know. They leave that there. That's growing nicely. I like that. So, but I love that you've done that for the girls.
And it's kind of one thing to speak about it. Just to finish that point, it's just one thing to speak about it.
Yeah.
But there's one thing to do something about it. And you want to teach your kids about money. You've got to lay a very good, show a good example. You've got to lay down some good foundations. Because when they get to 12, 13, like that's 12, 13 years of compounding. That's, we know it, the magic of compound interest. It's like we've missed a good chunk of that. If we made it a decision, yes or no, it was like this is a hard yes, we're doing it. So, definitely having kids, you learn to put your priorities later and after.
It's funny, isn't it? Yeah. And I love to, you mentioned 12 or 13. I feel like that's a really impressionable age for kids, and that's when they really start to understand the cost of everything and the cost of living. I mean, we used to take our boys to the grocery shopping and get them to work out, the value before they put the, how much it was per kilo or grams, on the little tags on the, and we would get take the calculator shopping and get them to work it out. What's the best bargain? Just because but it was a little bit of fun to distract them shopping, but it was also a lesson for them. Yes. So that's just what we used to do.
Now what we do is we do our delivery on Coles online. So we don't take them to the shops because that ends up becoming more expensive.
Actually, to never go shopping hungry. That's my top tip there. You end up with the entire shop in your cart because you're just hungry and you're like, oh, I'll get that. And it's not good for my waist then, because if the Tim Tams are on special, it's disastrous because I'll just like buy 6 packets of them and then they're all gone the next day. So just, and I have no idea who eats them, Aaron. No idea.
Yeah, no, there's that Tim Tam fairy that just sneaks in and steals them all.
It's that's it. That's it. So now everyone knows that Tim Tams are my weakness. So if you want to influence me, Tim Tams are the thing. So thank you for sharing about your relationship with Bernie. It's really great to hear a man that was the actual frivolous one, because I think a lot of media tell women that they're the frivolous ones. So then we just think, oh, it's us. But it's really nice to hear that there's a man that was frivolous. So, and I love that you've now managed to work with that, as I have, because I was the frivolous one. And you've got to look out for your triggers, right? If there's something triggering you, you've got to be like, oh, no, stay away from that. And if sometimes it's certain people, so I've had to take certain people out of my life momentarily because they encourage me to spend, and it's disastrous.
I think as time goes on, like you think like the as you earn more, like the stakes get higher. Like when you're, I don't know, 20 something, it might be like a cheaper car. It might be a nicer, you know, I'm going to Thailand, or it might be something along those lines. As you move into your 30s, it's probably clothes, for example, or, you know, some of that discretion or going out. As you get into your 40s, it's now designer handbags and watches and cars. The stakes just got a lot higher, and it's far more zeros as well. And I think it's, we call it lifestyle creep. You call it comparison. You call it envy. Whatever it is, keeping up with the Joneses, however you want to kind of wrap it up and justify it. But then it's like the house with the U-Butte renovation on it, and the fancy pools on it. Like, there's a danger in playing that game. I mean, there's nothing wrong. Here's my thing. There's nothing wrong with, if you've earned it, you save for it and you buy it, there's absolutely nothing wrong with any value it. But when it's the ill intentions behind it, that's when you know that it's just like, it's not for personal satisfaction, it's for outward validation. Check yourself on that.
I think so. And I think as you get older, actually, your view of that changes, because I know when I was a little younger, so I'm 52 now, nearly, well, 53 this month. We're recording in March 24, so 53 this month. But I think as you get older and your priorities change, I don't know whether that's because you become more mature or maybe it comes down to the experiences you've had along the way. But I used to see people with beautiful homes and beautiful cars and think, oh, wow. But now I see that and I'm like, oh, man, how much debt are they in for that? Like, no, thank you. I don't want that much debt for that. And it's like, where actually, I even look for downsizing now, because it's like, yeah, we have a nice home and everything, but, you know, we could probably live in a nice little villa somewhere and help the boys get into something, or, you know, so it's like, I think your priorities change. And cars, I used to like nice cars, but I drive a Mazda 3. I like it. I love my car. You know, it's, and I just like, I just, yeah. And then we went and looked at an electric car a little while ago and test drove, and it was like, man, that's a lot of money. I don't know. I know we're going to save on petrol and stuff, but I don't know if I want to spend that much money on a car that's going to get me from A to B. I'm just not sure I want to do it, and I'm just not in a place. I'd rather have the holiday with the money.
Yeah.
So you kind of prioritize what you want in life. So, and I'm not interested. I could drive a scooter as long as it gets me down to the shops. I don't care. As long as it takes me to get my coffee, I don't care.
Yeah, I think that's a massive ego check, isn't it, Kylie? Like the car is, you know, they're built up to be an extension and symbol of your wealth, and the ego certainly wants it, because, you know, you mentioned you drive a Mazda 3. I did. I traded in a awesome Golf GTI, walked out of the dealership with the check, and traded in my brand new car for, I think it was a 10-year-old Mazda 3. And the first question I got was, hey, is business not going well? I'm like, it's actually going better, the fact that I don't need a nicer car to prove it now, which is, you know, again, contrary thinking. And again, it's not to show off, but it's just to go that I'm not going to play this game, which is the fancy car to prove that I'm doing well.
No, No,
and that's not a statement for everyone. Some people really, really, really enjoy their cars. And so I'm like, if that brings you happiness, that brings you joy, then mate, do it. Do it. And
yeah, exactly. But if you're doing it to impress someone else, you've got to check what you're doing that for. Yeah. You might want to rethink. Yeah. I agree. Aaron, you wrote a book.
Yes. Yes, I have.
And I'm really excited about it. We're coming to the launch. I'm really excited to get my hands on a copy. I actually am. I set myself a goal to start reading again, and I have started reading again. So I'm actually really enjoying it. Mind you, I read of a night time, so I read about 5 pages and I get too tired and have to go to sleep. But I read. I have to go to sleep, yeah. So tell me about what made you want to write a book, and then tell me about the book.
Yeah. Look, I didn't have a burning desire to write. I have to be an author. I have to get my name out there. That wasn't the intention. What it was, there's only so many conversations that I can have one-on-one in a week. There's only so many conversations my team can have one-on-one, or we can do webinars, seminars. But what I found was a lot of people need to go on a journey, which means they need to absorb information in their own time. And then it's a tactile, you know, reading a book, it sinks in a lot more as well. So that ability to remember, recall what you've read, you can go back to it as well. So the book to me is a culmination of years. Like I've been doing this nearly 10 years. 10 years of conversations that have really kind of hit the spot, that have landed well, that have been, you know, that have gone on to help people buy property, get into the market, for example. And so I want to say I just wrote a book. It's like, yeah, it wasn't that hard in the sense to take all those conversations that I've had over 10 years, distill them down to like, you know, 30 to 40,000 words and go, right, here's a bit of structure because it's what people need. And when the penny drop moment for me was when I read about the home ownership dream just getting out of reach for so many younger Australians. I'm just fortunate that I happened to be born 10 years before, you know, other people, and I was able to get into the market 10 years before other people. If I was trying to get into the market today on a median income, I'd feel despondent. I'd feel like the market is moving faster than my ability to save. And that may be the truth of the market, but there's still people that are buying and still getting into the market. It's just a different way than what was done by our parents or the generation before us. And so the goal for the book is, if we want people to get in, don't be tone deaf and go, hey, buy a property. It's going, well, show me how. And this book is the blueprint about how. Yeah.
I love it. And what is it called? I know what it's called, but I'd like to hear you say it.
Yes. I think it's called the Happy Home Loan Handbook. And if I give you some context,
love that name.
A lot of people
say, yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So people see a home loan as a ball and chain. They see it as like, in financial planning, sometimes it's called bad debt because it's owner-occupied, it's non-deductible debt. But let me tell you, a home loan can be the happiest debt because it means I'm not renting. It means that I've been able to get a mortgage from a bank. It means that I've got security, stability for my family. It means I can add value by a renovation or, you know, making the garden line. It means I can be part of a community on a street where I've got awesome neighbors that take the bins in and out for me when I'm on holidays. Like, that's what it means.
Ours mow the lawn for us.
This is it, right?
Mow the front lawn, they trim.
Street Christmas party. Like, I never got that when I was living in an apartment in Sydney, right? We knew it was transient. We knew it was transactional. People were going to move in and out, for example. You didn't really build those relationships, when you're renting. And you knew at some point you were going to leave anyway. Versus when you have your own home, you've got a vested interest in making sure this community is thriving because I've bought into this community.
Exactly. And
what's the alternative to having a mortgage? You've got to rent. But at some point the landlord's going to put up the rent, going to send you out a notice because they want to do some renovation work or sell the property, which you now rent, you got to look again. That's disruptive if you've got a family. That's disruptive if you've got a lifestyle that's set up in that place and now you've got 3-4 weeks to go and find a brand new rental in a rental crisis that we're suffering in this country. So it's a lesser evil to go and get a mortgage and pay that off and pay it instead of paying someone else's mortgage off for them. And I think renting serves a purpose for a time in our lives. But at some point, I meet so many people that have a yearning to buy their own home, and very, very rarely have I met anyone that regretted buying their own home.
Yeah, We definitely don't regret buying our own home. So we lived in a completely different area. You know, for varying reasons, we had to move. So we bought the block of land where we are now. But to buy a block of land in this area now is like close to $1 million just for the block of land. And they're small blocks of land. But we only paid $300,000 for the land and then built the home. So we just had the house valued at much more than what we, you know, have paid. But I think too, with you buying your own home, this is just from our personal perspective, we bought the home here knowing that we would potentially want to retire somewhere else. And so we kind of looked at this as an investment, even though it's classed as bad debt because it's our home. But we looked at it and thought, well, once we hit the right age, we're going to take advantage of the downsizer contribution into our super, right? So because we've been in our home more than 10 years. So, you know, if you can kind of look forward at different kind of strategies, I don't think there's anything wrong either with getting into the market and living somewhere if you can, because I guess there's the first home loan buyers, all that sort of stuff that you can take advantage of as well if you want to live there. And I think same goes for rent vesting, you know, just,
you're spot on. I think what you said there is it's an interesting one, right? Because if you think back to generations gone by, you never saw your home as an investment. It was a roof over your head and that's what it was. Whereas now we know we're going to trade up. Like you use your last property as a stepping stone to buy this place. And that's a new phenomenon where it's like, hey, where am I going to buy? And this property better increase, or how do I make it increase in value, right? Whereas in generations gone by, that wasn't the case. And when I did a lot of research into home ownership, and you know, your parents would have bought a house at 2.5 times their household income. We're now buying houses at 7.5 times two incomes versus our grandparents only ever had one income, or our parents only worked on one income. And so the game has changed so much that what worked for a parent will not work for a child.
No.
As harsh as that sounds.
No.
Yeah.
I know. And it's interesting. You know, you hear a lot of people say, well, I did it. But, yeah, you did it 20 years ago. It's completely different landscape now for investors. And
20 years ago.
And, I mean, that's why we – sorry?
So the 20 years ago, the real estate agent drove you out to the house in their car, right?
Exactly. Well, see, I was lucky enough to meet Anthony. He already had a home when I met him that he was renting out. So we actually moved into that when we kind of got engaged and renovated and eventually knocked that down and rebuilt a bigger home on that block. But we sold that and then came to where we are now. So, but we did rent in between and, But the book, The Happy Home Loan Handbook, so it's been launched soon. I can't wait to get my hands on a copy. I'm really excited. In fact, I might buy a couple of extras just to hand out to some clients, so we might do that. I'd really love to know, before we wrap up, the top tips that you would have for someone. So let's talk about top tips for mortgage brokers. So they're not all created equal, right? Mortgage brokers, we've spoken to lots of mortgage brokers. We've looked to partner with lots of mortgage brokers, and you guys are one of the ones that match our values and our ethics. You know, that's kind of why we are happy to send clients your way and vice versa.
Yeah.
So when someone's looking for a mortgage broker, and we tell people as well, looking for a financial advisor, I don't care if you come and see us, but go and get help. But if there's three things that they should look out for when they're looking for a mortgage broker, what would it be?
Yeah, it's what I'd call, I get this a lot when people say, why us?
Yep.
And I usually say it's what I call the three E's. So one is experience. They've either done it themselves. And what I mean by that is, I'll give an example. We've bought commercial property. We've bought our own home. We've bought investment properties. We've renovated. Yeah, I'm not saying that about any ego. It's just that there's experience that we've got personally having done things. And there's brokers that have bigger portfolios than me. And like, well, they're the ones that you go to for a huge portfolio, right?
Yeah.
So there's experience. There's empathy that I'd say. Mm-hmm. And around that is going, hey, I've been in your shoes and I know what needs to happen. And exactly what you're doing is I can understand the ebbs and flows of emotions that comes into it. And that's a big one. And then the last one says emotional intelligence. And that's the third E. the bonus E is going to be expertise. Like, hey, look, we've got an actual sweet spot around a niche. I'll come back to that in 1 second. But the emotional intelligence is a big one where you go, this is a highly, highly emotional journey. Getting a loan approved, you take people on a roller coaster where it's like they're fearing if the bank's going to say no. Is the bank going to say yes to this loan? You're like, mate, absolutely. They don't want our word for it. They want the bank's word for it. So as a broker, you've got to be able to coach people through this emotional roller coaster of being able to get a loan approved and ensuring that, you know, all the money that they've saved up for isn't going to be lost when they go to buy this home. It's people's greatest fear. And so nothing I say to them, hey, I've done this, you know, 10 years, never lost a deposit, never missed settlements. That doesn't matter, because all that matters is their situation and what they're going through.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so a lot of brokers, it's hard to taint the industry. It's a male-dominated industry, for example. You know, males typically don't display a lot of emotional intelligence, and that's something that we really work on with our team, going, show some empathy, show some emotional intelligence, because this is people's greatest, one of their greatest stress points in their life. And the last one that I'd say is expertise. So expertise is, hey, look, we've got a team that's specializing in first-time buyers. I've got Bernadette, who specializes in commercial SMSF. I specialize in investors, for example. So when you have a level of depth and knowledge there as well, it's like, yeah, I know exactly what your thoughts were. I know exactly what your pain points are, because I've helped numerous people like yourself as well. So you can't be all things to all people, which is why we have to divide and conquer when clients do come into us. But again, when they get a specialist over a generalist, they know they're usually in good hands because we've been there, done that.
Yeah, and I love that. I really love that. So thank you for joining me today. Oh, no, sorry. I want three top tips for, sorry.
That's all right. Let's get back to that.
Coffee hasn't kicked in. I had the coffee an hour ago, but it hasn't kicked in. no, I want your top three tips for couples. So you and Bernie are a couple. You're in business together. What are the top three tips that you would have for couples that are in business and for talking about money? What's your...
Top three tips. I'd say the first one is
putting you on the spot. I know.
Yeah, that's right. You can't build a house of two different blueprints. So you need to have a alignment on a blueprint. Yeah.
Yes.
So hey, what are we looking to do? What's our ultimate goal here? If you're out of alignment, anything after that's just not going to make any sense. So you've got to get on the same page. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If the second step is, if you can't get alignment, then you definitely need a professional. You need a financial planner in your corner. You know, mediator, someone in there, a budget specialist, whatever you've got to unlock whatever pain point that we've got from an alignment perspective. Mm-hmm. And then I'd say you need someone that's going to take ownership of this. So, again, the analogy that Bernie and I use is you don't see two captains going out for a toss of the coin, on the sporting field. One person is the leader, one person is the captain, And someone then has to be responsible with the other person's support and the other person's buy-in, for example. And then the last one, so we've got kind of three, we'll make it four, but then there's got to be consistency and regularity around catch-ups. So if it's a monthly date night, if it's a fortnightly date night, we do an hour catch-up around our business at the end of the month. We then talk about our personal finances. We've got a spreadsheet that we both have access to in terms of our cash flow for the month. So we know what are the expenses coming in, what are the expenses going out. We know how many holidays we want to take this year. We know what it takes, what our minimum break-even point is on our household and what our break-even point is on our business. If things are unexpected, we've got the Scotty Pate buckets, for example. If there's an emergency, we've got money for the emergency. We know how much is in our super. Yep. We know how much our mortgage is. So there's the other part, which is actually not digging our head in the sand, but just going, hey, look, I know my numbers. And when you probably deal this all the time, when I ask people, how much do you earn? I don't know. I was like, that's a critical number to know. It's a critical number. If you don't know your number and how much you earn, it's how much you're worth. Like, we've got to recheck this a little bit. It's not that you walk around beating your chest going, this is how much I earn. I think it's endearing sometimes that people don't know how much they earn. But when you're going to pick up the phone and call a finance professional, that's kind of one of the things that they want to know. So you should have that information. That's pretty handy.
Yeah, it's one of the first things. Yeah, yeah.
What are we working with? The income question is not around judgment. It's going, hey, what are you working with and where are you at in your life and your journey? Then I can then take
that. That's right. Well, how much are you earning and how much are you spending? Exactly. You have a spreadsheet. You know exactly what's coming in, what's going out. So it's not a budget as such. It's just like a a map of where your money's going. You need to know what you've got left over so you know what you can do with that. You don't know what you can do with it. Unless you know what your goals are, your blueprint. Yeah, exactly.
A business. Yeah.
All of that was music to my ears.
But you go look at business coach will play the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was sitting here, you were saying all of that, and I'm like, oh my God, if I was in the same room, I would have hugged you and kissed you. I love it when you're
trying to help people, and that's I think again you talk about the conversations that land and you go, hey, look, these are pain points. If you've been doing this for long enough, you generally know, hey, these are the pain points that we have to suffer. And my book's no different. Money books, when you pick them up, it's usually how do you spend less, how do you save more, how do you invest better. They usually fall into one of those three sweet spots. And I think for my book, it's going, okay, how do we help you stop renting? How do we help you get into your home? How do we help you pay your loan off faster? And how do we help you at some point invest in the future? But it all starts, like all journeys, they start at the very beginning. How do we take that first step? And then the step after, and the step after that as well. And if we can help you guys, if we can help more people have the confidence, self-belief, and the support that we can help more people get into the property market, isn't that a real joy? There'd be nothing. Yeah, there's no absolutely. Greater joy than that. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I know how thrilling it is. I mean, we've got two investment properties, but I know how thrilling it is when you buy your first one and you're like, wow, I've done it. Or even any home. It's just – or investing. Just it's like I've started. It's just that first step to start – creating that future that you've always dreamt about, because it's not unobtainable, but you've got to know what that future is first before you do anything. I was going to ask you, I was going to say our son's 21st birthday is coming up in July, so perfect gift for him. I'm going to get a copy of your book for him because he's
beautiful,
got dreams of being a property mogul, so that'll be a great gift for him.
How exciting is that? When I see young people trying to get into the market, I'm like, a young person trying to get into the property market, hats off to you. I love it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's very tight with his money, I've got to tell you. Beautiful. So he gets that from his dad. He's very tight. Very tight, which is a good thing and a bad thing.
Yeah, it's
Well, not a bad thing, but it is good. No, it is good. But Aaron, so people can find you on Instagram, LinkedIn, and Facebook. You've got an excellent website. I love your website. So I'm going to have all of the links up for everyone. They can go along and follow you. Your book is launched on the 21st of March. Is that correct?
Yep.
2024. Correct. So and where is that available? Bookstores, online?
Yeah, so the bookstores, you can go Booktopia, Amazon, some Dimmicks will have it, Harry Hartog, and then some of the
We've got one in Penrith,
There you go. Online's probably the easiest part for a lot of people, get to a Booktopia. If you want to go to a bookstore, there's a couple there that have it. And, very keen to get people's feedback. We've had a couple of people who have already picked up the book and reached out to us. So I'll get a real... getting a real kick out of it. It's all new feelings for me because now people they're reading it and absorbing it, and now they're actually reaching out. I'm like, this is amazing, this feeling that people now want to take action off the back of reading it. What would those people maybe have done before? They might have stumbled around in the dark, but this has become an enabler. It brings a lot of joy.
Yeah, it is exciting that somebody's reading your words and they're taking action from it. I can imagine the joy that would be, So maybe I might write a book, Aaron. You've inspired me to actually write a book.
And that's exactly what happens. Like I've had people that have gone around, people before me in my circle going, they've wrote a book. And, again, that's had a massive impact on their community as well. And I'm hoping me going, hey, look, it's not that hard. You definitely need to carve out the time and the energy and space to write a book. And I was lucky to go away and write. But here's the thing, like if we can just make that ripple effect bigger, it starts here, then you guys can create something and inspire someone else to do something. It's like, hey, this ripple effect is getting bigger and bigger, and the rising tide is lifting all these ships. Happy days.
Yeah, Yeah, love it. I love it. So thank you again for joining me today. I really loved chatting with you again, and I have been a guest on your podcast, so I might pop that link up there just for good measure so everyone can go and have a re-listen to that. But I'll have all of the links on for everyone to go and follow you and to buy the book. I would, even though I haven't read it, I highly recommend it because you are really one of the good guys, Aaron. I really love your business, and I love your website. You have got an amazing website. I love it. The changes when you're and you're a bit of an amateur chef too, aren't you?
I'm a frustrated master chef. My brother has a couple of restaurants, and he won't hire me, but I'm trying.
Well, now you know what you can do when, you know, the business is running itself. You can go and do your chefing.
That is, I tell you what, that is the dream. Once you sell this all up and you get a little cafe, I love what food
wouldn't does. That be great? It
brings people together.
It's sitting around eating and drinking coffee all day. How fantastic would that be? I'd love it. Again, Aaron, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, mate.